Thank you, Patch. I was glad to meet your wife.
She was glad to meet you.
This is a challenging post to try to do justice to send you on your way, as it were, and I want to do that by addressing what I think is one of the most challenging and but important opportunities that you face as Christian educators, and that is the rise of musical illiteracy and aesthetic relativism in our day. I have been lately saying, if I was the devil, I would take music away from people. So I want to look at something of the reason why music is important in our lives as a part of education, and particularly as a part of our life as the church. And I'll take an hour to do it, even though we started late. I just want to warn you. In the second volume of his treatise, Syntagma Musicum, published in 1619, composer and musician Michael Praetorius wrote the following: Almighty God alone can never be given sufficient thanks for having granted to man in his mercy and great goodness such gifts as have enabled him to achieve such a perfect, one might almost say the most perfect, creation and instrument of music as is the organ in its arrangement and construction, and to play upon it with hands and feet in such a manner that God in heaven may be praised, his worship adorned, and many moved and inspired to Christian devotion. It's interesting to me that Praetorius, in the praise he's offering, doesn't commence it by saying how much he likes the sound of the organ. He calls attention instead to its perfection of arrangement and construction. It's how the thing works that impresses him. Praetorius is one of a very long line of Christian thinkers who commented on the virtues of the organ as a symbol of cosmic harmony. Long before organs were even permitted in churches, which was probably sometime in the 10th century, they were praised by Christian churchmen for the way in which their mechanism was a concrete, visible, and audible metaphor for spiritual realities. Tertullian, no friend of pagan culture and its forms, nevertheless praised the predecessor of the pipe organ in his treatise De Anima on the Soul, written in the early 3rd century. In commenting on the unity and diversity of the soul, Tertullian writes, quote, a single body is made up of various members, so that there is unity and not a division. Observe that marvelous creation of Archimedes. I speak of the hydraulic organ, with its many parts, sections, connections, passages. Such a collection of sound, variety of tone, array of pipes, and yet it all constitutes a single entity. So, too, the air expelled from below by the agitation of the water is not thereby divided into parts because it is distributed into different places. Rather, it is one in substance, though diverse in function. In the 12th century, sometime after organs had been admitted to the churches, a Bishop Baldric, who served in the northwestern section of France that became the province of Normandy, wrote the following in a letter to the people of one of his parishes. For myself, I take no great pleasure in the sound of the organ, but it encourages me to reflect that, just as diverse pipes of differing weight and size sound together in a single melody as a result of the air in them, so men should think the same thoughts, and inspired by the Holy Spirit, unite in a single purpose. All this I have learned from the organs installed in this church. Are we not the organs of the Holy Spirit? And let any man who banishes them from the church likewise banish all vocal sound, and let him pray with Moses through motionless lips. For ourselves, we speak categorically, because organs are a good thing, if we regard them as mysteries and derive from them a spiritual harmony. It is this harmony that the moderator of all things has instilled in us by putting together elements entirely discordant in themselves and binding them together in a harmonious rhythm. As we listen to the organs, let us be drawn together by a deeper harmony and be cemented together by a twofold charity. As musicologist Quentin Faulkner observes, the early appearance of organs in churches may well not have been so much for practical music making as for symbolic and didactic ends. Symbolic in that the instrument was the material embodiment of cosmic harmony. Now, in addition to the symbolism of the organ's mechanism, Faulkner notes that there were aspects of the quality of sound that were theologically attractive to churchmen. Early medieval organs were quite different from the pipe organs we have today. Originally, they had only a single rank of pipes, and the sound they produced was rather austere and unexciting. But that was seen as a virtue. As Faulkner writes, the very quality of the sound produced by the medieval organ had an affinity to the Christian ideal of cosmic harmony and to the objective, non-affective music which that ideal produced. In other words, music wasn't a means to excite emotion immediately, but to convey an oral impression of the objective structure of the universe. As Faulkner continues, the sound had practically no expressive qualities, and only the slightest capacity for nuance, if indeed it had any at all, little variety in tone, very little rhythmic capabilities, and no potential for crescendo and diminuendo. It was remote in its playing mechanism, remote from its listeners, often in a balcony or a swallow's nest high up on the church wall, and in a remote, mystic, and awe-inspiring acoustic environment. Its most unique musical characteristic, the ability to hold a tone at a static dynamic level, theoretically endlessly, was distinctly superhuman. If one assumes, as the Middle Ages did, that variation and fluctuation belong to the human spheres, while awe, remoteness, and constancy are characteristic of the divine, the mysterious, the holy, then the qualities enumerated above would seem to render the organ a peculiarly hieratic, that is, priestly, musical instrument. Now, I'm starting with this material this morning not to launch a defense of organs in church music, nor to endorse without reservation late medieval views of the nature of the divine. What I want to introduce is the matter of how earlier generations of Christians worked to think seriously about the nature of music and more generally about the criteria for the church's embrace of cultural change. At some time, 1,000 years into its history, the church decided to change its tradition of exclusively a cappella music and allow the introduction into its liturgical life of an instrument that had centuries of pagan associations. If Quentin Faulkner's telling of this story is correct, and we have a lot of reasons to give it credence, the rationale for this adjustment in the church's cultural life was not because the instrument was generally popular, and therefore lots of people would like it. In fact, your average medieval churchgoer had less experience with organ music than your average American teenager does. It wasn't because worship leaders regarded the instrument as a useful tool for generating enthusiasm and a sense of participation in the worship experience. In fact, from Bishop Baldrick's remarks, one gets the impression that unless the benefits of the organ had been explained to them, it would have held little implicit attraction. The organ had little in the way of immediate or widespread popular subjective appeal. The use of the organ was deemed fitting because its way of working, the way it produced sound, the kinds of sounds it produced, all had likenesses to cosmic and spiritual realities. Fittingness, not popularity or effectiveness, was the criterion. It was meet and right so to do. Church leaders concluded that the nature and the use of the organ properly represented reality in some way. Not only was the instrument itself fitting, but the kind of music it played well was appropriate for divine worship. The theologians and church leaders of this period assumed that there was an order in creation which could be apprehended and known through music. And this is why music, along with arithmetic, geometry, and astronomy, was one of the four disciplines included in the quadrivium, the four ways which completed the classical trivium of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and which together comprised the seven liberal arts. So if you wanted to study theology and philosophy in the late medieval universities, you had to study music first. I think that's a good requirement seminaries ought to have today, but by the way. In fact, in the Orthodox Church, I know that you can't be ordained unless you've studied at a conservatory attached to one of their seminaries. Music was the experience of the numeric realities embedded in the cosmos, embedded in time through the and experienced through the senses. Even today, people often describe music as a way of ordering time or a way of perceiving the order that is time. For medieval thinkers, in fact, for most Western thinkers prior to the modern period, the order of the cosmos was a standard for guiding the order of the soul and the order of society. In the words of theologian Colin Gunton, there was an assumption, quote, that human life is good life when it conforms itself to the way things truly are, when it takes shape in the world as it truly is. Gunton points out that, in general, it was held in the ancient world that knowledge of the universe contained the key to human society. In this respect, the Old Testament is no different from other contemporary religious writings, close quote. Pre-modern Christians and pagans alike understood culture as the cultivation of a given nature, not the creation of an arbitrary new nature. As Louis Dupré has summarized pre-modern Christian beliefs, quote, as he has summarized those beliefs, a divinely established cosmic order determines man's place and prescribes the norms of behavior. Political structure had to conform to cosmic hierarchy. The entire universe is conceived as a gift endowed with a meaning that is man's task to discover and express. In fulfilling this task, man finds at the same time his own meaning, the content of which is given in the two books of Nature and Revelation, close quote. And music was assumed to be an instance of, a revelation of, this cosmic, divinely established reality. One of the manuscripts in the library of Johann Sebastian Bach was a treatise on counterpoint written in 1725, in which the author, Johann Joseph Fuchs, referred to art and defined art which imitates and perfects nature but never destroys it. This idea, of course, is articulated in Aristotle, and it's one that the very Lutheran Bach endorsed. As Bach scholar Christoph Wolff argues, for Bach, art lay between the reality of the world, nature, and God who ordered this reality. In Bach's thinking and in his compositional efforts, musical structure, harmonia, ultimately refers to the order of nature and to its divine cause. Or, as one of Bach's students wrote, music is a mixed mathematical science that concerns the origins, attributes, and distinctness of sound, out of which a cultivated and lovely melody and harmony are made, so that God is honored and praised, but mankind is moved to devotion, virtue, joy, and sorrow. In his recent biography of Bach, which is subtitled The Learned Musician, Christoph Wolff presents Bach as a musical Newton, as a man consciously committed to the discovery of and delight in the ways of God in creation, specifically as those ways could be known through musical forms. Bach believed that an order in the universe can be perceived and should properly serve as a model for human making and doing. Not just in music, but in all the arts, in science, in law, in politics, and in the life of the church. In this older way of perceiving reality, cultural institutions and forms weren't arbitrarily or capriciously or willfully engineered and selected, but they were developed and approved in faithful resonance with the order that God has established in the cosmos. Culture is the cultivation of created nature. Healthy cultural forms were faithful to the structure of creation. Unhealthy cultural forms were the product of human desire suppressing or denying the created order. But even by Bach's day, the apparent glimpses of the transcendent in music and in other arts were coming to be regarded by many as wishful thinking. Not so much because their view of music was more modest, but because their view of the cosmos was changing. In our time, that transition has long been complete in the larger culture. Nowadays, writes Jamie James, most scientists would accept the thesis that the cosmos has no underlying logic in the classical sense, but is rather a confluence of accidents, which are governed by laws. However, the laws themselves are irrational and do not arise from any fundamental orderliness. The concept of the universe as a random, meaningless place was expressed on the earthly level by the theory of evolution, the mutations that determine the course of life on Earth, and indeed the very creation of humankind, were revealed to be largely fortuitous events. But even today, even despite our official ideology about chaos in the cosmos, one often encounters this older view of music and the cosmos, the shape of the cosmos, in the work of various artists, poets, and writers, who seemed to question the scientific reductionism that has eclipsed that older view of music. Consider this passage from a 1999 novel by Neal Stephenson, a book called Cryptonomicon, which features prominently a character named Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse, a mathematical genius and one of the world's foremost experts in cryptography and cryptanalysis, the making and breaking of codes. Lawrence's father, Stephenson writes, was a congregational preacher who taught Greek and Latin at Bolger Christian College in West Point, Virginia, near the James River and near a big paper mill. The boy, writes Stephenson, had a peculiar relationship with sound. When a fire engine passed, he was not troubled by the siren's howl or the bell's clang, but when a hornet got into the house and swung around the ceiling in a broad lissajou, droning almost inaudibly, he cried in pain at the noise. And if he saw or smelled something that scared him, he would clap his hands over his ears. One noise that troubled him not at all was the pipe organ in the chapel at Bolger Christian College. The chapel itself was nothing worth mentioning, but the organ had been endowed by the paper mill family and would have sufficed for a church four times the size. It nicely complemented the organist. A retired high school math teacher who felt that certain attributes of the Lord, violence and capriciousness in the Old Testament, majesty and triumph in the New, could be directly conveyed into the souls of the impugned sinners through a kind of frontal sonic impregnation. That he ran the risk of blowing out the stained glass windows was of no consequence because no one liked them anyway and the paper mill fumes were gnawing at the interstitial lead. But after one little old lady too many staggered down the aisle after a service, reeling from tinnitus, and made a barbed comment to the minister about the exceedingly dramatic music, the organist was replaced. Nevertheless, he continued to give lessons in his retirement. And Stevenson writes that young Lawrence, who was only 5 years old, taught himself to play a Bach fugue on the piano so that he could be admitted for organ lessons, which he then continued for many years. One day in his 12th year, the organ broke down, and the math teacher had to pop the hood to fix it, asking Lawrence for his help. Here's what Stevenson writes. For the first time in all those years, the boy saw what had been happening when he had been pressing those keys. For each stop, each timbre or type of sound that the organ could make, block, flute, trumpet, piccolo, there was a separate row of pipes arranged in a line from long to short. Long pipes made low notes, short high. The tops of those pipes defined a graph, not a straight line, but an upward-tending curve. The organist/math teacher sat down with a few loose pipes, a pencil and paper, and helped Lawrence figure out why. When Lawrence understood, it was as if the math teacher had suddenly played the good part of Bach's Fantasia and Fugue in G minor on a pipe organ the size of the spiral nebula in Andromeda. The part where Uncle Johann dissects the architecture of the universe in one merciless, descending, ever-mutating chord as if his foot is thrusting through skidding layers of garbage until it finally strikes bedrock. In particular, the final steps of the organist's explanation were like a falcon's dive through layer after layer of pretense and illusion, thrilling or sickening or confusing depending on what you were. The heavens were riven open. Lawrence glimpsed choirs of angels ranking off into geometrical infinity. This visionary experience, as this young man begins to understand how music works, was a clue to the readers of the novel that Lawrence turns out to have an intuitive grasp of mathematics, a deep and ingenious sense of pattern and of rhythm and of structure, which makes him indispensable when, during World War II, he ends up working for the Allies at Bletchley Park solving Nazi codes. In Stevenson's description, Lawrence discovers something not just about the way organs work, but something about the nature of reality itself. The shape of that curve in the rank of pipes was not an arbitrary convention, but something that bespoke the nature of things. Now, whether or not novelist Neal Stephenson actually believes that music reveals some cosmic transcendent reality, I'm not certain, but one does get the sense that he would like to believe this. Now, this is unfortunately a minority view among most of our contemporaries who regard music as a purely subjective mode of expression and who think that musical taste is private and unchallengeable. I know a young man in Charlottesville who, in his mid-20s, decided to learn to like jazz. And he spent about a year or two. He had an uncle who was very knowledgeable and passionate about jazz, but he had no liking for it, no understanding of it. But he believed that there must be something objectively present in jazz to merit his time or energy. So he spent a year or two in deliberate and thoughtful and very attentive listening. And in time, as he came to understand what was going on, as he became familiar with the vernacular, he came to really like jazz. Now, he was telling a friend of his, a young woman, a Christian woman, about his age, about this journey, and he could tell that she was shocked with what he'd done. And then apparently rather disturbed by it. She had nothing against jazz, but she thought that learning to like a new form of music was a kind of unnatural act, not the sort of thing that respectable people did. He was flabbergasted by her response, and as she explained it, he realized that she believed that music and musical tastes were so subjective, so arbitrary, so idiosyncratic, that any effort to change one's taste was almost immoral. It was to violate yourself in some way. One's subjective tastes were the most intimate, almost sacred part of one's being, so to try to transcend or alter them would be akin to self-mutilation. Now, this young woman, like most of our contemporaries, couldn't imagine that musical forms presented an opportunity to know something about the nature of things, making the cultivation of new layers of musical literacy a worthwhile project. Music critic Julian Johnson, in his book, Who Needs Classical Music, has observed that in our day, in matters of musical judgment, the individual can be the only authority. That's what's assumed. Here's what Johnson writes. This is in sharp contrast to the relatively minor status of individual taste in Western musical practice and aesthetics from the ancient Greeks until the late 18th century. To an earlier age, our contemporary idea of a complete relativism in musical judgment would have seemed nonsensical. One could no more make valid individual judgments about music than about science. Music was no more a matter of taste than was the orbit of the planets or the physiology of the human body. From Plato to Helmholtz, late 18th century music critic, music was understood to be based on natural laws, and its value was derived from its capacity to frame and elaborate these laws in musical form. Its success was no more a matter of subjective judgment than the laws themselves. Now, our belief about making judgments about quality in any art form is now captive to what art critic Jed Pearl calls laissez-faire aesthetics. Laissez-faire aesthetics, he writes, has left us with a weakening of all conviction, an unwillingness to take stands, a reluctance to champion or surrender to any first principle in aesthetics. This relativism in aesthetic judgment is simply a part of a larger suspicion about all value judgments, a suspicion that has been described by Alasdair MacIntyre and others as emotivism. The doctrine, as MacIntyre explains in his book After Virtue, that all evaluative judgments, and more specifically all moral judgments, are nothing but expressions of preference, expressions of attitude or feeling, insofar as they are moral or evaluative in character. Now, it would appear that conservative Christians, to a large extent, who would seem to be unlikely allies for relativism concerning truth and goodness, have been all too ready to embrace relativism with regard to beauty, especially in music. Now, this is not a new problem among American evangelicalists. Years ago, I ran across an essay written in 1876 by the great Southern Presbyterian theologian Robert Louis Dabney. Some have said that Dabney not only wouldn't suffer fools gladly, he had problems with a lot of sages. The subject of the essay was Dabney's sense of the danger of what we would today call parachurch organizations, Christian ministries that are not under church authority. Dabney was a very convinced and confirmed Presbyterian. Dabney was not a friend of entrepreneurial religion, and he focused on in this essay on what he saw as the great irregularity of the work of the independent evangelist Dwight L. Moody. Dabney believed that the absence of ecclesiastical authority meant that all sorts of heresies could be present in public proclamation by Christian teachers without any regulatory discipline. But in the last two pages of the essay, almost as an epilogue, Dabney comments on the remarkable work of Ira Sankey, who, after quitting his job with the IRS, became the musical power behind Moody's public meetings. He was the George Beverly Shea of the 19th century. Some of you don't know who George Beverly Shea was. So, sorry. I can't think of a better analogy. Somebody can help me later. Sankey, who in the late 1970s was admitted to the Gospel Music Hall of Fame, is said to have written over 1,200 gospel songs, including many that I grew up singing. Blessed Redeemer, Faith is the Victory, How Can I Keep from Singing, A Shelter in the Time of Storm, The 90 and 9, and Under His Wings. Ira Sankey was the great-granddaddy of contemporary Christian music and of worship and praise choruses. But Dabney didn't like it. He was less than impressed. The most that can be said of Mr. Sankey's songs, he writes, is that they do not appear to have introduced positive error yet, and that they exhibit no worse traits than a marked inferiority of matter and style to the established hymnals of the leading churches. The most danger thus far apparent is that of habituating the taste of Christians to a very vapid species of pious doggerel, containing the most diluted possible traces of saving truth, in portions suitable for the most infantile faculties, supplemented with a jingle of vain repetitions. Gotta love the guy, right? What shall we gain by giving our people these ephemeral rhymes in place of the immortal lyrics of Moses, David, Isaiah, Watts, and Cooper, so grand in their rhythm and melody, so pure in taste, and above all, so freighted with compact and luminous truth? The old wine is better. Now, what interests me about Dabney's assessment of Ira Sankey is the fluidity with which he combines theological and aesthetic judgments, specifically his assumption that poetic and musical maturity was as desirable as and inseparable from spiritual faithfulness. In 1876, Dabney could still assume that there was a hierarchy of aesthetic judgments publicly recognizable by those who had the ears to hear, and that habitual exposure to puerile aesthetic forms, especially in the name of religion, was not a healthy thing. A quarter of a century later, several years before Sankey's death, Lutheran music historian Edward Dickinson, who taught at Oberlin College's Music Conservatory, confidently expressed his sense that the musical tastes of educated Americans were steadily improving, even as many churches seemed more in sync with the products of Tin Pan Alley. Writing in 1902 in a book-length survey of Christian music, church music in the West, Dickinson insisted that aesthetic weakness in church music ought not to be accepted in the name of true inner piety. The most devout intention, he writes, will not make the church music effective for its ideal end if the aesthetic element is disregarded. There seems to be, in many quarters, a strange distrust of beauty and skill in musical performance, as if artistic qualities were in some way hostile to devotion. And later, Dickinson asserts that it is a fallacy to assert that the masses of the people are responsive only to that which is trivial and sensational. In any case, he seems to be saying, even if it is true, what shall be said of a church that is satisfied to leave its votaries upon the same intellectual and spiritual level upon which it finds them? What's interesting about Dickinson's comments is his unapologetic insistence that churches can properly encourage their members to grow in musical understanding, which, until 20 or 30 years ago, many churches still were willing to do. The musical program in many churches was decidedly educational, setting a standard for congregations and so informing their musical tastes, not just what they did in worship, but what they listened to throughout the week. But populism, laissez-faire aesthetics, has largely triumphed in the church as in the wider culture. St. Paul's advice to the church in Philippi once guided the custodians of the church's culture, who were custodians of the Spirit as well. Whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Unfortunately, we've come a long way in the past few decades. Many Christians rely on the PANSV translation of the Bible, the Personally Authentic Non-Judgmental Standard Version. In that version of the text, Paul's exhortation in Philippians has been simplified and abbreviated, whatever. Now, in case you haven't guessed, I regard the church's effective abandonment of its musical legacy as a huge tragedy. It's changed its musical habits to be more in tune with the habits of the broader culture without asking why the broader culture has turned its back on the Western musical tradition. The displacement of much of our society's artistic standards and expectations by the enchantments of entertainment is an indication of cultural decline with a complicated set of causes. And among them is an ever more radical celebration of the autonomy of the individual self and a hostility toward authority, an increasing suspicion that the past has anything useful or instructive to offer us, a growing impatience with cultural pursuits that are demanding in our time or in our intellectual effort, an aversion to the idea of cultivation and a celebration of forms of expression that are untutored, instinctual, and allegedly authentic, and a fascination with anything transgressive coupled with cynicism toward the maintenance of a tradition. Now, all of these attitudes are obviously destructive of Christian faithfulness, as well as detrimental to cultural health. And it is the flourishing of these mentalities that has led to laissez-faire aesthetics and to the indifference within our society to the great achievements of the Western cultural tradition. In his 2007 commencement address at Stanford, National Endowment for the Arts Chairman Dana Joya commented on this forfeiting of artistic opportunities. "I worry," Joya said, "about a culture that bit by bit trades off the challenging pleasures of art for the easy comforts of entertainment. And that is exactly what is happening, not just in the media, but in our schools and in our civic life. And I would add, it is happening in our churches as well. The church once assumed a role of cultural leadership, assuming that it should set a good example for her neighbors, not just in morality and theology, but in forms of aesthetic expression, in architecture, in poetry, in art, and in music. Today, it's a rare congregation that assumes that kind of responsibility. This negligence has a sad consequence for the church's testimony. If we add momentum to the prevailing assumption in our culture that our engagement with creation, including our engagement with the sonic order in which music resides, is to be defined only by personal preference and not by something actually residing in the nature of things, how can we hope to bear witness to a sovereign creator who ordered all of reality and who stands in judgment against those who reject his ordering of things? Music is a great and unique gift from God. And the Western musical tradition that developed into what we commonly call classical music was in significant ways shaped by the influence of the church in its desire to cultivate the full and remarkable capacities of this gift. By failing to sustain a mature appreciation for the capacities of music within the church, we lose one of the greatest resources God has given us in bearing witness to his glory and to something of the glorious order he has imparted to creation, including in human nature. Now, of course, carefully composed music, like all art, cannot be experienced immediately. It requires attention in time and over time. Artfully contrived music develops in time and so must be attended for its duration, whether the 5 minutes of a song or the 40 or 50 or 60 or 70 minutes of a symphony or the hours of an opera. Music finds its perfection in time. And this fact in itself has theological lessons about the nature of creation. And most serious music can't be understood without paying sustained attention to it. Because of electronic media, which allow and encourage the use of music in the background and discourage us from becoming participants, our experience of music today is predominantly used to establish and sustain a mood. It's like Prozac or sonic wallpaper. As a result, as music critic Julian Johnson observes, what remains unpopular about classical music is its discursive aspect. The claim of classical music is that in order to make musical sense, it requires concentrated attention from start to finish. I want to add that Johnson and many other musicologists have suggested that this narrative or discursive quality in Western classical music developed because of the influence of Christian liturgical structure. That is, worship services followed a dramatic flow from procession through confession through final acclamation. And the idea of music that takes time to become what it is, was based on the experience of worship, which takes time to rehearse the unified yet diverse aspects of God's interaction with us and our responses to his initiation. Musicologist Quentin Faulkner argues that the way polyphony, multi-voiced music, developed beginning in the late Middle Ages through the Baroque and into the classical period and beyond is inconceivable without the formative influence of Christian ideas, what he refers to as Christian speculative thought. In his book, Wiser Than Despair, Faulkner writes, "There are those who hold that the church impeded the advance of music. The evidence presented this far in my book ought to contribute to a more balanced, fair view of the matter. Christian ideas shaped the progress of music constantly, decisively, and positively, long after the rising tide of ideas not generated by Christian thought wrested music from the church's control." So, for instance, by the early 19th century, when the church's ideas were no longer as dominant in the culture, you have a great figure like Beethoven, who nonetheless, in Faulkner's telling, wrote music that was deeply under the influence of Christian ideas of what music is. He cites a couple of works, rather extended works by Beethoven, and he says, "Why all these abstruse polyphonic devices? Why is it so complicated, in other words? Why this painstaking emphasis on form? Balance of sections, key areas, themes. You know, why does it have to be so intricate? Surely Beethoven could have reached his listeners' feelings by a far more direct route. We need only compare it with a work like Ravel's Bolero or any piece of late 20th century popular music. You can get there in a hurry." The answer is that Beethoven was writing in a lofty, noble musical language whose vocabulary was partially determined by the musical conventions of his own time, partially by the force of his own musical personality, but whose grammar and syntax, and thus a part of whose context, were in large measure an inheritance from ideas determined by Christian speculative theology. Indeed, it does not seem an exaggeration to say that the Western notion of unity achieved by formal balance and cohesion as a primary determinant of musical quality or greatness is inconceivable without the underlying shaping force of Christian metaphysical speculation. The metaphysical speculation Faulkner is referring to begins in the patristic period. It's very evident in the Middle Ages, but it survives in the thinking and composing of Bach in explicitly Christian form. And by exploring the sonic world guided by those metaphysical ideas, composers discovered something in and about creation. As theologian and musician Jeremy Begbie has recently written, the Western musical tradition guided by the church demonstrated, quote, that we have been placed in a world vibrant with its own God-given integrities and with the opportunity of interacting fruitfully with those integrities, and that music is one means we have been given to do just that. Music does testify to something in the nature of things, and the Western musical tradition in particular, a legacy of Christendom, discovered and recorded all sorts of wonderful musical realities. How tragic for the church to abandon that treasury of wisdom. I don't have time, obviously, to enumerate all of those discoveries. Besides, it would be better to listen to them than to talk about them. Elvis Costello was exaggerating a little bit when he said that talking about music is like dancing about architecture. But only a little bit. It's the character of musical knowledge to resist being capturable in words. And that fact alone tells us something about creation. Robert Schumann, once asked to explain one of his rather difficult etudes, is said to have sat down and played it again. I think Flannery O'Connor did something similar with one of her stories. Literary critic George Steiner is only one of many commentators who has observed that the meaning in music can't be reduced to words, and yet that its meaning is so powerful and so compelling is a great testimony to the fact that human being is linked with something real and transcendent, something ineffable. In his book, Real Presences, Steiner writes, "Our capacities to compose and to respond to musical form and sense directly, to respond to musical form and sense directly implicate the mystery of the human condition. To ask what is music may well be one way of asking what is man. The question as to whether anything meaningful can be said or written about the nature and sense of music lies at the heart of this essay. The truths, the necessities of ordered feeling in the musical experience are not irrational, but they are irreducible to reason or pragmatic reckoning. This irreducibility is the spring of the argument in this book. It may well be that man is man, and that man borders on limitations of a peculiar and open otherness." In other words, we're close to the transcendent, if I can paraphrase. "It might be that we are that kind of creature because he can produce and be possessed by music. One of the ways in which music testifies to the uniqueness of human nature, suggesting that we are in fact made in the image of God, is the way in which the material and the spiritual are commingled. And this becomes more and more profoundly evident the more artfully the music has been composed." Julian Johnson talks about this phenomenon in that book I mentioned, Who Needs Classical Music? And he makes the case that music as art, music that requires attention to its development in time, provides a unique mode of experience that combines the emotions, the intellectual, and the physical in what he calls a special kind of thinking. Johnson's argument suggests that attending to classical music provides a way of challenging, on one hand, the materialist reductionism of our age, which says we're only matter, and on the other hand, its somewhat paradoxical consort, a spiritualistic Gnosticism, which says that we can do away with our bodies because we're pure spirit. In music, body and mind, as well as time and eternity, find a necessary interaction. Outwardly, Johnson writes, classical music appears to be highly repressed. Its dress codes, its body language, its restraint and formality all seem to point to a denial of the bodily. I've heard people say this, that you can't just dance in the aisles at symphonic concerts, and hence that classical music is opposed to the bodily. It's kind of Gnostic. Above all, the image of the classically trained listener sitting silent and immobile throughout the performance would suggest that classical music shuns the immediacy of bodily expression. People do not dance in the aisles. People do not dance in the aisles at classical concerts. This is an important difference between classical music and popular music, and ample evidence that classical music and popular tradition simply do different things. But classical music is based not so much on a denial of the body as on a different balance between its bodily and non-bodily elements. Much classical music is rooted in the bodily, but aims at transcending without denying these physical origins. Classical music comes from the body, but is about being more than the body. It enacts the quitting of the body through the bodily. Hence, its fundamentally ritualistic and mythical power, representing in the physicality of the body our spiritual aspirations to be more than bodies. He's writing this as a non-Christian, I should say. But there's a yearning here that I think is palpable. Classical music, Johnson continues, finds expression for our experience of exceeding the immediacy of the bodily. Without losing sight of the simple, the bodily, and the raw, it projects a sense of transcending those origins and an aspiration to realize a being not confined to the bodily. Classical music projects a content that exceeds the materials from which it begins. It projects something that arises from the patterning of its sounding materials, a form of a melody or a phrase or a whole piece that is itself an intangible, ungraspable idea. The music is a process of thought that takes off from the tangible, but is not restricted by it nor reducible to it. In this, it mirrors ourselves, which we also conceive of as exceeding the bodily conditions of our being. We insist on being more than physical objects. We insist on our identity as something intangible and irreducible to physicality, even while our being is rooted in our physicality. This is the humanist position from which classical music begins. Its essence is found not in the physical, but in the content it projects beyond its physical elements by means of their formal patterning. In doing so, it elevates us from the bodily, not out of disgust of it. Classical music is not short of dance, song, and desire, but precisely to celebrate our twofold nature, the tension of spirit and body that defines us. The subtlety, complexity, and refinement of classical music are not arbitrary ways of distinguishing those who participate in it from those who do not. They are the qualities of a humanist culture. They are the qualities of a humanist culture that has valued as the condition of our humanity the qualities by which we have defined the humanist ideal to which we aspire: reflective thought, tempered passion, care for the particular balance by awareness of the whole, imagination, self-determination, persistence in the face of adversity, freedom. What a wonderful list of attributes. And I would say this is very incarnational. Johnson would not claim that classical music is unique in offering this opportunity. But whatever musical form aspires to achieve this, it will have to have some of the formal similarities to classical music, which is why I think jazz has some similar opportunities, because of its deliberateness and formal structure. It would require a temporal commitment, something that can only be perceived over time, in which harmonic, melodic, and rhythmic variation, development, and recapitulation can take place. It will, in other words, require some formality. And that may be the biggest obstacle to retaining the experience of the Western musical tradition in the souls of 21st century Americans. We've all been conditioned to crave immediacy and to regard with suspicion any cultural experiences that require our submission to formal demands. It's not simply that we have a problem with people who claim to exercise cultural authority. We're so accustomed to immediate experiences that we tend to resent cultural experiences that require cultivation. And we especially resent the idea that our emotional responses need to be trained. Since modern thought has taught us that our instinctive desires are the most honest, the most sacred part of our being. How far we are from a Christian or, indeed, a classical anthropology and psychology. Modern people resent the suggestion that our tastes need to be trained, and so we prefer music that we can respond to without training. And yet, as the classical tradition, affirmed by the Christian tradition, insists, education is nothing if not the training of the affections. As C.S. Lewis insisted in The Abolition of Man, which I think is his most important work, quote, "Until quite modern times, all teachers and even all men believed the universe to be such that certain emotional reactions on our part could either be congruous or incongruous to it," that is, to the universe. "Believed, in fact, that objects did not merely receive, but could merit our approval or disapproval, our reverence or our contempt." Music, of course, appeals more directly to the emotions than to reason, but it appeals to the emotions through reason, that is, through a kind of attentiveness and a kind of awareness, a kind of intellectual awareness. Lewis was united with most classical and pre-modern Christian thinkers that the emotions, or more precisely, the affections or the loves, needed to be trained just as much as reason needed to be trained. He cites St. Augustine, who defines virtue as the ordering of the affections, or ordo amoris. Excuse my Latin, I'm just so pathetic. "The ordinate condition of the affections in which every object is accorded that kind and degree of love which is appropriate to it." As Lewis writes, "Aristotle says that the aim of education is to make the pupil like and dislike what he ought. When the age for reflective thought comes, the pupil who has been thus trained in ordinate affections or just sentiments will easily find the first principles in ethics. But to the corrupt man, they will never be visible at all, and he can make no progress in that science." Plato, before him, had said the same. "The little human animal will not at first have the right responses. It must be trained to feel pleasure, liking, disgust, and hatred at those things which really are pleasant, likable, disgusting, and hateful. Your students are in great need of the training of their affections with regard to beauty, no less than with regard to truth and goodness, although they are culturally disposed to resent it very much. And particularly with regard to music. If music really is a unique merging of spiritual and material, of temporal and eternal, of intellectual and emotional realities, in some way an experienced emblem of what the incarnation is and what our imago is, if it is the perceptual activity, if it is rather the perpetual activity of angels and the eternal destiny of the redeemed, then its capacities shouldn't suffer from neglect or carelessness or expediency or impatience. Like the kingdom to which it bears witness, music is a pearl of great price, worthy of sacrifice, diligence, and joyous discovery. Thank you.